Morning.
Good morning. My name is Jack Sheridan, and I am the attorney for the plaintiffs. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes, please.
Two?
Yes, please.
All right.
All right. So we are here because the trial judge's rulings, when all put together, show an abuse of discretion. This is a discipline case brought under the Washington law against discrimination. Hertz claimed that they told each of the plaintiffs, who were the shuttlers, to clock out before prayer and sent each home when they violated that order. So the charge was insubordination. There was evidence in the record that Hertz had to tell each worker 3 times to clock out. And on cross, I was not allowed to ask any adverse witness to identify the plaintiffs to whom they gave this order. So we had a room full of plaintiffs at the trial, much like a wedding where a group of people is sitting on one side. We had 25 plaintiffs most of the time in their traditional outfits. And we asked, I asked at various times through the trial, individual witnesses to identify which persons they had told had to clock out 3 times. And each time the trial judge made a ruling that it was an argumentative question.
So, and with regard to our role here, is this constitutional error or non-constitutional by the trial?
Well, we have not alleged constitutional error. We've couched this as simply a cumulative effect of evidentiary errors. So what happened is the defendants got away with portraying the plaintiffs as a fungible group, basically identifying these people who did not follow the rules without ever having to point the finger. Imagine a 25-defendant case that's not a conspiracy where each person is alleged to have done something wrong. Well, the prosecutor would start each case by having the witness point to that person and say, that's the one who did it. Well, that didn't happen here because we have we just weren't even allowed to do it. We have an appendix that is the clerk's papers 2601 to 2665, where we listed for the trial court after trial over 100 evidentiary rulings that were just wrong. And they're numbered. And as to identification, it's 21, 22, 24 regarding Matt Haney, the manager, 51, 52, 53 regarding manager Harris, 77, 78, and 88 regarding other managers. But the problem is, of course, that affects our ability to bring the case effectively to the jury. And the thing about that I think stands out in the defense briefing is that they don't disagree with our argument as to what's the definition of argumentative, compound, or the other things. They just seem to skim over it. But an argumentative objection is one that basically is sort of rhetorical. You're not really asking the guy to answer. You're really just trying to make closing argument to the jury through the context of a witness.
In looking at this area in general, I was struck by the lack of cases that deal with this sort of situation. There's cases, I think the Baxter case, where the judge just said, it's 4 o'clock, you're done, and that's clearly error.
Right.
But these decisions that the trial court made are so discretionary. Maybe that's why there's no cases.
Well, it's not that.
So what would our test be here?
Right. Well, it's not that there's no case law. There's no case law in Washington.
Okay.
I mean, we just need to do a better job as attorneys of bringing these cases to you so you can develop that case law. I mean, we cite, I think it's People versus Chapman in California, where an example is, I think a prosecutor asked somebody if the safe was lying, the safe, and they said, well, that's argumentative because it's an inanimate object and can't lie. But, I mean, that's the kind of questions. Argumentative is much different than being an aggressive cross-examiner. That's our job. That, you know, that's, as we set out in the case law in our brief, which is Washington case law, you know, this is the core of how you prove a case. And these are the toughest cases to bring. These are cases where we never have direct evidence. These are cases where we have to use circumstantial evidence. The second and third witnesses on plaintiff's case were adverse. They were the top two managers. So if we can't go forward and really effectively cross-examine them, you know, we're done before we start. And the judge just truly misunderstood what an argumentative objection was. So
moving on to the pretext jury instruction.
Yes.
Since we do have limited time.
Yes.
There is the Castanis case in Washington.
Right.
How do you distinguish Castanis for purposes of the giving of this instruction?
Well, remember that what Castanis does, it's protecting us. It's that shifting burden analysis is just too difficult to understand. Basically, we go with substantial factor because it's easy to understand. But jurisdictions around the country have figured out that that's not quite enough, that this is very hard to prove. And remember, we have the added liberal interpretation aspect of our statute. But if you look at what Townsend says, and that's the case that we cite, it basically says that, look, trial judges couldn't figure it out. So how are you going to expect a jury to figure out that there's a pretext, that if we can't believe what these people are telling us, then perhaps we should win? So I would suggest that the jury instruction that this court should consider has really been modified somewhat by Scrivener, because Scrivener basically gives us the two pieces. So we said that that you may have a permissive inference that the defendant stated reasons for the decisions are not the real reasons as one basis, but are a pretext. Or Scrivener, I think, would add that although the employer's stated reason is legitimate, discrimination nevertheless was a substantial motivating factor. Now, those federal cases we cited found that it was legal error to not include those. So we hope that the court will consider that. But also consider that we weren't able to challenge credibility of the main adverse witnesses, we had laid foundations in the court. In the first witness, we lay the foundation. In the second witness, there's an objection that, you know, assumes facts not in evidence. And we had to constantly rework. Trials are not meant to be that hard. On foundations, the judge objected on there was objections to foundation when we asked, isn't it true that you did this? And the judge, and there's an objection foundation. Well, if it's you, it's a simple yes or no question. So the fundamentals of cross-examination were basically broken. I hope the court the defense has not raised the issue of whether or not an offer of proof was necessary, but I don't think it's an issue, and I just want to point the court to the case State versus Ray, which is the Supreme Court case on the matter. They didn't raise it, but, you know, pretty much the context of each one of these 100 objections is quite obvious in the record. Anything, any particular questions?
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Mark Filippini with K&L Gates, and I'm counsel for the defendants' respondents here. I'd like to start addressing the question of pretext because it is, I believe, a fairly easy one for the court to resolve. The standard of review, of course, on jury instructions is that they must allow the plaintiffs to argue their theory of the case. They must not be misleading. And when they read as a whole, they have to properly instruct the jury on the applicable law. And that's what happened here. The jury was largely instructed out of the pattern jury instructions, including, importantly, Washington Pattern Instruction 330.01. That is the disparate treatment pattern instruction. Both sides proposed it without modification, and it was accepted by the trial court. The comment to that rule not only notes that there is no pretext pattern instruction, but also that it's not proper to give one.
That's the substantial factor instruction. Correct?
That's the substantial factor instruction. And in the comments, it notes that an instruction or language on pretext is inappropriate.
But when we, and looking at Castanis, it does seem to deal with the burden-shifting issue. And after the Supreme Court decided Reeves, then the federal circuits sort of divided over this. Some circuits say you've got to give a pretext instructions. Others say don't give a pretext instruction. So it seems like maybe the comment to the pattern instruction isn't as up-to-date on that as possible. So.
And on the federal circuit, there really are two that have gone where the plaintiffs would like, and that is the 10th and the 8th. The 5th, they correctly cited, there was a case where the 5th Circuit went there. However, we don't have this in our brief, because that was cited on reply, but there was a subsequent Fifth Circuit decision where they disagreed with the panel that had decided that and asked for or proposed that there should be en banc reconsideration of the holding in the earlier Fifth Circuit case. So additional cases are out there from the 9th, the 7th, the 8th, actually, the 11th, and the 6th Circuits, all indicating recent cases that pretext instruction is not appropriate, so long as the plaintiffs have a full opportunity to argue their theory of the case. And that happened here. Counsel was very skilled and argued repeatedly that the defendant should not be believed, that pretext indeed is the torch. As he admits in his briefing, he's got his declaration. It's how he prefers to try cases in this area. And that is what plaintiffs did here.
Well, as I understand this issue, this is instruction that is proposed is not really a burden-shifting instruction. It seems to me it would be in the category of a permissive instruction where there is concern that argument alone would not suffice to let a jury know that just because people say something, you don't have to believe them. I mean, you can argue. That's certainly permissible to argue that person up there that's saying, you know, no way, did we ever mean anything like that? That we really were doing this because of cost savings or some other deal. You could just say, you know, that's just a pretext.
Correct.
You could say that, and you know, there wouldn't really be anything wrong with a court giving this instruction, would there?
No, we agree, Your Honor.
Violates Castanis. I mean, this is in a different category of instructions.
We agree it was a discretionary decision for the trial court judge, and we believe the correct decision was made here. We point out Castanis in the briefing to show that in another case involving employment discrimination that got to the Supreme Court in a different setting. It was the defendant that had urged it there. The court has an excellent quote that it's a summary judgment standard that drops out when the case gets to the jury. If I could use my remaining time, I'm of course happy to answer any questions, but just to briefly reset the key facts, I think, or procedural posture items from our brief. So as plaintiff noted, this was a case about historical break abuse. Plaintiffs were taking their full paid rest breaks plus paid break time for prayer. So another way to look at it, they were praying while on the clock. That's uncontested, by the way. Every plaintiff admitted that as part of their case in chief. September 30th, 2011, Hertz institutes a rule that all shuttlers must clock for all paid break time. It's objective, it's fair, it's intended to give them data so they could recognize the scope of the problem and correct it. The plaintiffs and eight other individuals refuse to clock out for prayer. They're suspended for insubordination, and then they're subsequently terminated when they reject an offer to return from work from the general manager, Zaidun Abdallah. And it's important to note, we strongly disagree, and there's plenty of record evidence. These were individualized determinations on discipline and discharge. In each case, we offered extensive evidence, including cross-examination of the plaintiffs, that the individuals, in fact, had not clocked out for the breaks in question, that they received Mr. Abdallah's letter, and they decided to reject the offer to return to work.
Does the exclusion of Exhibit 1929 implicate potential evidence of evil motive?
It does not for several reasons. The court absolutely made the correct decision on that. So 1929 was an email from a low-level manager, Jeff Wilson, who it's from 6 months prior to the suspensions and terminations in question. It's undisputed that Mr. Wilson had nothing to do with the terminations and suspensions in question. And the email evidences his frustration in trying to apply a new rule in the collective bargaining agreement, this creation of something called mini breaks. So the parties, in order to accommodate prayer, had come up with the idea of an unclocked mini break where you could take your required 10-minute breaks, paid breaks every 4 hours, and divide them up into smaller pieces. And we created that to accommodate prayer. Mr. Wilson is having frustration as one of the frontline managers of the shuttlers because no one is paying attention to it.
Wouldn't Mr. Wilson be a speaking agent, particularly on that issue?
If the question at trial that we were here to resolve was something involving mini breaks, I agree that he would. But actually, what Hertz did 6 months later was very different. They instituted they essentially shut down the mini break option. They instituted an across the board clocking rule, all activities, all shuttlers for any paid time. That's a key piece that I believe led to Judge Roberts concluding that he was not, in fact, a speaking agent on that issue 6 months later. It's also not a business record. We believe that the judge got that right. Even in plaintiff's view of the world, it was a momentous document rather than evidencing a plan that was hatched 6 months later by others. So certainly not something that's along the line of a clerical notation or a payroll or something like that. And also under 403, we didn't argue that below, but of course you may sustain on any basis found in the record. It would have been completely prejudicial and confusing for someone who was not a defendant in the case, was not at all involved in suspensions or terminations, to have that admitted. But perhaps most importantly, and one thing I wanted to point out on that, is counsel had a full opportunity to walk Mr. Wilson through the email, and in fact, he did. And on that particular issue, Judge Roberts, there's a quote where he asks beforehand, well, can't I impeach him with it? And she says, of course, if he lies, you may impeach him with it. Never does. So the opening brief and the reply brief suggest, without citation, that Mr. Wilson wiggled. He didn't wiggle. We cited it in our brief. You can, if you want to look at the report of proceedings, counsel is reading right off of that document and walking him through it. He doesn't wiggle, so it gets into the record. In my remaining time, just a few, unless there's another question, a few key facts I want to focus on that we mentioned in the brief, but due to space considerations, I had to limit them, but I want to bring them out here. Of course, in a disparate treatment case, some of the most powerful evidence can be comparator evidence. And had good evidence that very strong, conclusive, I would say, that the plaintiffs were disciplined for what they did and not who they were. And that is that the Somali Muslim employees who complied with the clocking rule were not disciplined. There were two Somali Muslim employees, shuttlers, who clocked for all breaks starting on September 30th. We talk about the example of Hassan Hassan. That's in footnote 28 in our brief. Mr. Hassan, on September 30th, clocks for his full allotted break time, but he prays. In addition to that, he clocks for that. At the end of the week, when the managers pull the time cards, they see that he's done both. They coach him on it. He agrees to comply going forward, to pray during his break time, and he receives no discipline. There were also five shuttlers, Somali Muslim shuttlers, who were on leave. There were three new hires, and there were eight shuttlers who returned to work after receiving Mr. Abdallah's letter. So in concluding, we would say that plaintiffs had a very vigorous opportunity to argue pretext here. The problem with it, and they did, the problem is it would require the jury to find a wide-ranging conspiracy that involved co-workers, managers, plaintiffs themselves on some of the admissions they made at trial, and it simply was incredible, particularly when you look at a piece of evidence like Mr. Abdallah's letter, which they rejected for reasons that I'm still not clear on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, naturally, we disagree with the idea that Exhibit 1929 is not a business record. We laid a foundation for business record. The judge said, basically, in her view, most of the emails were not business records. So speaking agent, he's authorized to talk on that. If you look at the content, it's talking about, hey, team, here's what we're going to do. And it basically lays out the very plan that is executed 6 months later. As to the jury instruction, you know, we have a liberal construction provision under 4960 that the Title VII and other things do not have. The Eighth Circuit, Tenth Circuit, Third and Second Circuits have adopted it. And in the Townsend case, the court points out that failure to give the pretext instruction is reversible error, or could be, and they say we agree. They don't say you give it in every case, but they say that it ought to be given in any case where there is an issue like this of credibility. So we think this is a great opportunity to bring 4960 up in the same to the same level as the Eighth Circuit and others have done. With regard to, since I have a little bit more time, I wanted to talk a little bit more about Exhibit 1929. if you look at that transcript, before we tried to get that exhibit in and weren't allowed to, I asked on cross, it's true, is it not, of Mr. Wilson, the author of that, that you were creating a plan to have the persons who are Somali Muslim written up for insubordination, objection, argumentative, sustained, followed by one just like that. So I couldn't get that information in any form, and as you know, that if you can't show a witness a document and you're arguing to in front of a jury in sort of theoretical terms, it's just not as effective. If there's no more questions, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Before we take the next case, the court is going to take just a brief break.